still can't comprehend because they refuse to, I'll tell you where it went. Right into the ground, 6 feet deep. 6 minutes and 20 seconds with an AR-15, and my friend Carmen would never complain to me about...
A new report by the UN carries a stark warning. The world has little more than a decade to reduce the amount of carbon dioxide released into the atmosphere, or it may be too late to reverse the worst effects of climate change. Here's Mark Phillips.
I came here today because the health of our children are at risk across the state of Washington. And what these children represent is an effort in the state of Washington to give them what they deserve, which is clean air.
Earlier this month, the UN released a report saying we have about a decade to curb climate change and avoid catastrophe. This year alone, there were 262 mass shootings. In May, CNN reported that just 21 weeks into the year, there had been 23 school shootings. This week, we'll talk about why. I'm Dee Dee Madigan, and this is The Wrap-Up, the Daily's weekly podcast rounding up all of the news that you should know about. Today is Friday, October 26th. Last week we talked about voting. But this week and next, we'll talk about some of Washington's biggest races and initiatives. Washington State's Initiative 1631, which proposes a carbon fee, and 1639, which proposes new regulations on semi-automatic rifles. Representatives from each campaign spoke with The Wrap-Up to explain their initiatives in more detail. Unfortunately, no one from the No on Initiative 1639 was available to speak.
My name is Stephanie Felt, and I am the Washington State Policy Coordinator with the Blue-Green Alliance, which is a nonprofit that works to create and support good jobs in the clean energy economy. And as part of that, I was part of the policy team that helped to write Initiative 1631 over the last few years. And now I'm doing work in my individual capacity with the Yes campaign because I am a mom of two kids and saw them feeling sick this summer during the worst of the wildfire smoke when they had a outdoor summer camp and just really felt the need to step up my action to make sure that we are moving solutions forward. The way that it works is the policy would levy a fee on our largest fossil fuel polluters in Washington State. It would be applied basically in the middle of the fossil fuel distribution chain. So it's lower than refineries and it's higher than individuals and businesses. And it basically will impact petroleum distributors, natural gas distributors, and utilities that haven't yet changed over to clean energy. And the fee would start at $15 a metric ton of fossil fuels that are combusted in Washington State. And it goes up $2 a year until the state is on track to meeting its pollution reduction targets. And then the money that's generated is going to be used basically as like a Green New Deal for Washington State to invest in solutions. Yes, on 1631 side, this has been written and is now supported by the broadest and most diverse coalition in Washington State history. People who are ready for clean energy solutions. They're ready to lead and innovate in this space. They're excited to say yes. And on the no side, we have the most expensive initiative campaign in Washington State history. More than $25 million has been invested already. And again, 99.5% of that is from out-of-state oil companies. And, you know, the no campaign, it repeatedly makes claims that this is going to be costly and ineffective, I think is some of the terms they use. And, you know, when you have real conversations with people out on the street in the different events, what I hear people say is, I'm not sure I believe that you're in favor of any action. Like, if not now, when? And that's exactly what we would say. If not this, what? If not now, when? You know, the UN climate report that came out just a week or so ago said we have about 10 years to make significant changes in the way that we live and power our homes and get around. And to me, the response to that is not to retreat into fear or anything of that nature, but to say, hey, we're going to take some first steps. We want to make investments in things that we know reduce pollution, and we want to do that in smart, targeted ways that make sense for Washington State. And we want to do it now. And again, you know, just reflecting back on you know, myself as a parent, I want to make sure that when I look back on 2018, I'm able to tell my kids that I did everything I could.
Thank you for having me on. My name is Dana Bieber, and I'm the coalition spokesperson for the No on 1631 campaign. In its essence, 1631 is a deeply flawed, unfair, and ineffective energy tax that would force Washington families and small businesses to pay billions of dollars in higher costs for basic necessities like gasoline, electricity, and natural gas. In fact, it would cost Washington families $440 in the first year alone, increasing every year with no cap, and all the while exempting the state's largest polluters. Equally troubling is that the measure doesn't provide any specified spending plan and no real accountability. And an independent analysis was done that said after spending $30 billion over 15 years, 93% of Washington's greenhouse gases would go untouched. And that's why this is an ineffective and unfair policy. We have a broad coalition of over 200,000 Washington families, small businesses, farmers, labor unions, and consumers urging a no vote.
If not this, what then?
You know, the very nature of the fact that climate change is such a serious issue that deserves a serious response is the reason that we have to defeat this measure, because 1631 is so ineffective that it would leave 93% of our greenhouse gases completely untouched over a 15-year period. And that means we would not even come close to reaching our state goals. And that's why we have to defeat this measure, so that we can craft a solution that is effective for Washington.
Could you give maybe an idea of what an effective measure would look like?
I think we can all agree on a couple of things. If you want to have a policy that's effective and fair, you can't exempt the largest polluters in the state. You can't push all the costs down to Washington families and small businesses. You've got to actually have some real requirements, or at the very least, some assurances that significant reductions in greenhouse gases would occur, and you've got to be accountable to voters. And unfortunately, 1631 fails on all four of those tests.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. My name is Stephen Paolini, and I'm the campaign manager for Initiative 1639, Safe Schools and Safe Communities. I'd like to start some of these off by just sharing some of my personal connection. You know, I'm 22 years old, so hopefully many of the listeners are my age, and in our very sort of short lifetimes, over 200,000 students have been impacted by school shootings. And that's a number, I think, that's really unique to the United States of America, and it's unique to a country that says you can, you know, you have to be 21 years old to purchase a beer, but you can be 18 years old and purchase an AR-15. And so what Initiative 1639 does, the real main thrust of it, is making it at least as hard to purchase a semi-automatic assault rifle like an AR-15 as it already is to purchase a handgun like a revolver. And most folks don't understand, actually, right now in the state of Washington, you have to be 21 years old to go through a 5-day waiting period and a more enhanced, up-to-date local law enforcement background check before you gain access to any handgun in the state of Washington. If you can actually be 18 years old, walk into any gun shop in the state, and within a few minutes leave with an AR-15. And so the Initiative 1639 looks at two main sort of categories. You know, the first is that in the vast majority of mass shootings, semi-automatic assault rifles are the weapon of choice. And when these firearms are used in shootings, they result in 80% more injuries and 60% more deaths. So Initiative 1639 would do a suite of restrictions on those particular firearms, raising them to the standards that already exist for handguns. So for example, it would raise the age to purchase one from 18 to 21. It would require a 10-day waiting period, and it would require the enhanced local law enforcement background checks that are already required for handguns. In addition, if you look at a lot of mass shootings, and especially suicides, over 85% are due to an unsafely or entirely unstored firearm that a legal gun owner had purchased, but left within arm's reach of a child or another prohibited purchaser, and then that was used in crime. So, for example, look at the Parkland shooting, where a 19-year-old kid gained access to a firearm purchased by his parents, and it was unsafely or incorrectly stored within the home, and that resulted in one of the worst mass shootings in memory. So Initiative 1639 created a standard called safe storage, which would hold law-abiding, or rather legal, gun owners accountable if their firearm is left within arm's reach of a child and not stored. So it essentially says, you know, with your actions come consequences. And if you make the decision to, you know, not use a trigger lock or a safe or a lock box, and you leave your gun where it is easily accessible to a child, and then that gun is used in a crime, then you can face some steep accountability for that.
Yes, we don't, unfortunately, I wasn't able to get in touch with a representative for the Vote No, talking about some of their reasoning behind one of the things they bring up is that don't criminalize self-defense. You know, the whole point of having a gun, perhaps, is to be able to readily access it if someone were to break into your house.
Sure. It's actually kind of a silly premise that is not really predicated on an accurate understanding of what the initiative requires. So the first part here is that the initiative actually does not mandate that you store your firearm. What it says is if you leave the home unattended and you leave your firearm unattended, and it gains, you know, in a place that is reasonably expected to for a child to gain access to it and it's used in a crime, then you can be held accountable. So what that essentially means is if it's in your possession in home, if it's under your supervision while you're at the home, then you actually don't have to store it at all. But regardless of that, you know, the data shows that you're better off storing it. And as a gun owner myself, the way I store it in my home is with a trigger lock. And it's something I can access within 4 seconds. If I need my firearm quicker than that, it should be on my body or in my direct supervision and control. And as long as you're doing that, right, if you're in the home with the firearm in the same room as you and you want to leave it, you know, in a cabinet next to your bedside, if you really feel like that's necessary, you can do that under Initiative 1639 and you will not be held liable for anything whatsoever, period. So the idea that it somehow gets in the way of self-defense is totally incorrect. The initiative is really about it saying if you leave the home, if you leave the firearm unattended, it needs to be stored. And that just makes sense. You can't use a firearm for self-defense if you're not in the room with the firearm. So this law in no way affects law-abiding or legal self-defense. And one of the things I do want to put into perspective for everyone is this is a historic campaign for a number of reasons. Now, we will have passed the most comprehensive gun violence prevention measure ever put forward in the history of the state of Washington. We'll have collected and qualified the signatures for this initiative faster than anyone has ever done in the history of the state of Washington. That's a credit to the tens of thousands of volunteers that work around the clock to get this law on the ballot and to give us an opportunity to have this conversation that we're having today. It's an incredibly powerful thing that none of us should ever take for granted. The NRA actually sued us 3 times and spent hundreds of thousands of dollars trying to prevent this from being on the ballot because I believe they were afraid of the conversation. I think that's why we're not here today. Now, I think they're afraid of that conversation, and one of the defining things that you have to remember with this law is every single component of it was actually in the legislature at one point. And when this law, actually the first component, was introduced in the legislature, I was 3 years old. And since then, our generation has been deeply and irreparably impacted by gun violence. And so I think this initiative, at least for me, I hope it is for others in our generation, is a chance to tell legislators that they're wrong, you know, that they're cowardice in not doing anything to prevent gun violence from happening in the state. It's just wrong. And so if they won't keep our schools and our communities safe, we have a chance to do it ourselves. So again, thank you for inviting me. Giving me the opportunity to talk.
Different races in Washington state that are considered to be big races. This midterms, the Democrats hope to flip the House, and there are 3 seats up for grabs in Washington state that could help them do that. John D. Wilkerson, professor and chair of political science and the director to the Center for American Politics and Public Policy, who you heard from last week, breaks down these races and explains.
So the lighter dynamic in terms of congressional races is that If you have an incumbent running for re-election, usually the problem for the minority, for the party that's out of power, is to identify and attract what's known as a quality candidate to run against the incumbent. So incumbents have really high re-election rates. And the reason they have high re-election rates is there's this perception that it's hard to defeat an incumbent because they're able to raise lots of money, right, and they have name recognition to begin with. And so if I'm, you know, an ambitious politician and I'm thinking about, you know, developing a winning track record, I'm not going to enter that race. I'm going to wait for a race where, you know, there's a real possibility of me winning. And so in, you know, 90% of the races this year across the country, you have an incumbent running against what we would call a non-quality challenger, somebody who doesn't have a lot of prior political experience, they haven't been able to raise much money, and nobody's going to give them money. And then what you've got is a small percentage of seats, maybe 40 to 60 this year, that are deemed competitive because they're in districts that are, you know, competitive in terms of the Republican-Democratic split, or the incumbent has been involved in some scandal or something like that, or somebody has just decided to compete who is a quality challenger. So they've essentially, you know, said, you know, this looks like a pretty good year for my party, and so I'm, even though there's an incumbent in this race, I'm going to go for it anyway. And so that, so when we talk about control of the House changing hands and that possibility, we're really not talking about most congressional seats. We're talking about a small number of seats that are in play that could shift the difference. In Washington State, there are at least two seats like that. One is Dave Reichert's old seat, and Dave Reichert was the incumbent, and he has resigned. And so you have what's known as an open seat election, where you have essentially candidates from the Democratic and Republican Party who are both quality candidates, both getting lots of money, and it's a competitive district. And so anything can happen in that race. Probably the Republicans have an advantage given the distribution of the voters in that district, but, you know, it's also a midterm election year for an incumbent Republican president, and typically what happens is the president's party loses seats in a midterm election year. So it's, even though it's a Republican district, arguably, it's probably the best year imaginable for a Democrat to compete for that district, given that there's no incumbent running for re-election. The other district is in Spokane, where you have an incumbent. What's interesting about that race is, you know, you have a strong incumbent, but she's facing Kath McMorris-Rogers, who's facing a really well-known Democratic challenger. And so the Democratic challenger in that race has been able to raise a lot of money as well and make that a competitive seat for the same reasons, right? You have essentially she's trying to draw on the anti-Trump sentiments in the state in a district that's it's still a Republican district, but it's you know, one of the less Republican districts of the district as a whole. So you know, and then you have the rest of the districts in the state. There may be a couple more where surprises could happen, but for the most part, the rest of the districts are not in play.
And lastly, the other news you should know about. University of Washington Associate Professor of Psychology Christina Olson was named one of the year's MacArthur Fellows for her work with studying transgender children. Olson runs the nation's largest longitudinal study of transgender children with the Trans Youth Project. Olson's team found in a study from 2016 that when transgender children are allowed to live as their gender from a young age, it can stabilize their psychosocial development. Nationally, the Trump administration announced they're considering redefining gender as a biological immutable condition determined by genitalia at birth. This would roll back recognition and protections of transgender people under federal civil rights law. Olson says that one of her goals is to use some of the money to support thinking about new kinds of projects that she wouldn't be able to do through the traditional grant mechanisms. Last week, Valerie Richardson was named coordinator of the Title IX office, which oversees that the university carries out the objectives of Title IX through programs, initiatives, and services. Title IX itself states that no person in the U.S. shall, on the basis of sex, be excluded from participation in, be denied benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under any education program or activity receiving federal financial assistance. Discrimination on the basis of sex can include sexual harassment, rape, and sexual assault. New policies have been implemented at the Hub in an effort to clarify existing standards and address safety concerns. Hub Director Justin Computaro says the Hub experiences 4 to 6 safety and security incidences a week. Among the new policies are prohibiting sleeping for over an hour, sleeping on the floor, using bedrolls, and taking up large amounts of space. The University of Washington College Republicans hosted Charlie Kirk last Thursday, the founder and executive director of Turning Point USA. There were no major disruptions or protests. That wraps up this week's news. Don't forget to vote. I'm Dee Dee Madigan, and I'll see you next week.